Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're back for part two of our discussion about the offense in this game against the Texans. Not a lot to talk about with 40 offensive snaps, but joining me to do what there is to do is Sam Njoku. Sam, how you doing?
Pretty good. Nice to get in and talk some football with you. Not so much with the outcome, but definitely a lot of things to talk about here.
All right. Outstanding. I pronounce your name correctly. I always ask you when you're on the show, right?
You do. You get to just do a good
tight
job.
End, right?
Yep.
Very good. All right. Now he's all over the place. If you haven't caught Sam, he's on all sorts of pods. We'll get to that at the end of the show, but he has Zone Pod, a pod with Kadri Ishmael and Kevin Ostreicher, a pod with some other AFC North folks, but a lot of places you've no doubt seen Sam around in addition to being on Twitter. In the first episode, we talked about a number of things. The offensive line actually gave Cooper Rush a pretty different, pretty good opportunity set, and he managed to have three interceptions with ATS. We talked about the Ravens snap count failures. We talked about lots of other stuff too. What else?
We talked about what the Ravens could do differently moving forward here. I know the Ravens are getting healthy at the right time. I think they can get some better output from Isaiah Likely and Pat Ricard with the chip blocking there, because the offensive line is certainly going to need help, which we'll get into, I'm sure, in this episode.
There you go. So lots to go back. Please give that first episode a listen.
All right, well, time to get into it, because, Ken, I want to take control of this podcast if I can and touch on what this offensive line did. Again, you only talked about the 40 snaps that the Ravens had, but definitely a chance to look at these guys. Most notably, well, let's start with No Boom, because he did take the place of Ronnie Stanley, who didn't get into the game, tried to get in the game against the Kansas City Chiefs, and was put on the bench afterwards because of that ankle injury. What are your thoughts about what No Boom did in this contest, considering that he's had now about a game and a half to work with?
So last game, of course, Stanley, 15 snaps, as bad as he's ever been, honestly, just was not physically prepared to play that game. I think he probably really wanted to do it because it was the Chiefs, and maybe even the Ravens brass was kind of pushing him to do it in a way that might have been a little bit uncomfortable. But they decided to put him out there. He was terrible. Noteboom came in and actually played pretty well. Noteboom got a B in his first game. Complete reversal in this game. He played 40 snaps, as every offensive lineman did. That's 40 scored snaps. So those ones that didn't have a penalty, accepted penalty, didn't have a kneel or a spike, or a special teams play involving a runner pass, just to be entirely accurate about what there is. Made 30 blocks, missed four, but the big deal was he had contributions to six pressure events. So 3.5 pressures allowed, so that's 3 full and 1.5. He had half a quarterback hit allowed, 2/3 of a sack. So the sack that occurred on the S-16, it didn't actually occur for either of the players who it got charged to. Both edge rushers on both sides beat the tackles to phone booth the pocket, forced Rush to run backwards. And then number 97, I forget who that even is, made the sack. So if PFF's rules are they can't give that sack to anyone. Very clearly the responsibility of that sack is Noteboom and Rosengarten. I thought about 2/3 to Noteboom based on when his guy got there in a relative sense. So that was bad. He had 4 missed blocks. Other than his pressure events, 2 of those were losses at the line of scrimmage, 4 level 2 blocks. I talk about losses of the line of scrimmage, by the way. Those are much worse. When you get beat by the man directly opposite you, it often means that a pressure maybe might have developed on a play where the ball was out quickly. So you were at risk of that occurring. If not that, then it could be losses of the line of scrimmage on a run play where you maybe got backed up and somehow the runner didn't lose yardage on the play, but that still is a bad look. Falele had a lot of those in this game, unfortunately. But a tough game for Noteboom, only 17.5 points on 40 plays. That's 0.44. He needs to get a 60 on an adjusted basis to pass. I did give a fairly large adjustment for facing the pass rushing duo of Hunter and Anderson, but it's still only a 51 after adjustment for an F. So obviously Noteboom is going to have to play a lot better. I don't think we'd see 4 games in a row like this before the Ravens made a change. It might be less than that. And went either to Rosengarten at left tackle or maybe even going to Vincent.
Wow. I was thinking about this matchup before the game started. And again, to your point, I agree. Noteboom had a pretty decent game against the Kansas City Chiefs, and it gave me confidence heading into this game. I knew it was going to be tough with Hunter and Anderson in that contest, but you adjusted for that, and he still got a failing grade, which shows me that he struggled mightily in this contest, and it has me very concerned. Now, the bye week is coming up after this Rams game. So I'm very interested to see what the Ravens do. You mentioned it. They could move Rosengarten to left. He hasn't been, he's been hit or miss, in my opinion, so far this year at right tackle. So I think more than likely Vincent would be the guy.
It could be, Vincent. The other guy I didn't mention was Emory Jones is ramping up to play now. So the first week after the bye, I think he has to be activated during the time. So I believe it might be the next game after the Bears game is the game that they might have him return possibly. And if he did, tackle is one of the places where he could be used, or he could just be a backup. I think, you know, it's fair to say with Emory Jones, he hasn't had any camp time, any ramp up time, anything. I'm not really expecting a ton from him, but he's got to be on the list of names. And everybody wants to know, what about Emory Jones? What about Emory Jones? What about Emory Jones? Anyway, the way that Homer Simpson's mind is always saying, eat the cupcake, eat the cupcake to him. I'm not really expecting anything particularly soon from Emory Jones, but he's one of those players the Ravens need to find out where he is along the runway this year. He'll have more time to develop no matter what, but it's just, is he able to hold his own? Is he, you know, just below the kind of the C line where he's a great place to start for an NFL lineman, or is he a guy who's further behind than that or further ahead than that, for that matter, who they could have real high hopes for?
It's interesting because when he first was drafted, that was thinking immediately, oh, interior guard. I mean, a lot of guys who came out of college in that draft last year as tackle, I thought, oh, he's going to transition well to the guard. But the Ravens have made it known that they're going to try him out at tackle first. And to your point, he could be an option. Now, before the season started, I thought, oh, he hasn't practiced at all in camp. There's no way that he's going to get any playing time this year. That has certainly changed. I'm not sure. Again, he might not get much in the way of playing time. He may get put in certain instances. But, yeah, the Ravens would be – they would do well for themselves to find out what they have with this guy because, again – there's lots and lots of, you know, uncertainty in this offensive line, given their play, especially in this contest. Any more thoughts on Noboom?
Yeah, well, I'll stick with Jones for a second here. Jones really has ideal length to be a right guard as opposed to a left guard. I'm not saying he can't do it. The Ravens need some mobility from those positions. Jones, though, is a big, powerful dude who has longer arms and would be a guy who could handle that right guard spot. I think also if he's going to play tackle, he'll probably be a right tackle, not a left tackle. So if you move him to right tackle, that almost means Rosengarten has to move over. And then they've got the guy on the roster who's left tackle or bust, and that's Vincent. So at some point, maybe even this year, they want to see a little of Carson Vincent just to see where he is along the developmental track. I don't think they're going to like what they see in his first play, but maybe it'll be okay and they'll really love it, frankly, if that would happen. But I think technically he has had so many flaws watching him in camp get seriously up coached, even in the preseason where I thought he did pretty well against the twos and threes of other teams. He's got a way to go.
That's unfortunate too. Cause I was like, oh, put in Vincent. I mean, what's there to lose? You gave Noboom an F, can't get any worse than that, but you're thinking F minus if this guy goes on the field, right?
Yeah. Well, I do think he could score lower than a 51. I think that's certainly possible. I wouldn't even call a 51 adjusted a fall off the table game. That's like in the kind of the top end of the F range. We just had Stanley score basically zero, actually scored negative a half a point on 15 blocks. So it would have been negative 0.03. I don't give a grade for only 15 blocks, but that was so egregiously bad. It does get a lot worse potentially than what happened to Noteboom in this game.
I tell him, Ronnie Stanley, don't play if you're injured. Good comes from you being injured and playing. I know you're trying to get out there for your teammates, but you're not doing any justice for yourself. Is that grade, well, that score certainly dictated. Any more thoughts on Noboom before we move on?
Oh, no,
great. Awesome. All right, well, let's get on to Voorhees. Voorhees is very interesting to me because a lot of Ravens fans kind of gave him the nod of approval before the start of the season, and he struggled, in my opinion, at least in the early goings of this contest. How would you fare him in this game?
So he's coming off two straight good games, by the way, and he really needed them because his first two games had been failing by 3 points in aggregate. So that was really hard to do because even looking at Fa'alele's first 14 games last year when he played very poorly, he never had as bad a two-game stretch as Voorhees had in the first two games of this year. So I'm just framing this up for you. By the way, it's not quite as bad as how Noteboom played in this game. If Noteboom had another game this bad, then – he would take over for the worst two game stretch kind of thing. But Voorhees, you know, being a guard also was more comparable, obviously, to Falele for starters. Then he put together two Bs in a row, and you're thinking, this is really good. Maybe they've got something here. I will just say, if you're trying to figure out offensive line scoring, it just does not look the same week after week. It's not a steady state thing. It's more like reading the box scores daily on a paper, and the hitters get into hot and cold streaks, and you see that, and Aaron Judge hits two home runs one day, and the next day strikes out four times, and it doesn't help the team very much. And you have a lot of that in offensive line plays. You have good and bad games. A lot of it's opponent dependent. Same with baseball, but Voorhees in this game had a tough one. Two pressures, one half a quarterback hit. He missed six blocks. Now, here's what's good about the six missed blocks. He had zero of those were losses in the line of scrimmage. You're going to see in a second where most of them occurred. But he tripped entering L2, I think, once. He had another one where he missed an L2. And then he made only one of five pulls in the game. So that was really bad. He did have Tim Settle a fair amount. Tim Settle is a very talented interior defender for the Texans. By the way, his family was obviously there, or otherwise there's the weirdest collection of number 98 Texans jerseys all together that I've ever seen. But usually when you see that, it's the family of the player, particularly when it's not a Lamar Jackson or a star player or something, when you see that.
Right. That's pretty good to hear from about Voorhees, one, because I thought that he's been playing not so great all year, but I think it might be that the first two games were stuck in my head as being so egregiously bad that I was just looking for, you know, a stellar performance. But a B grade isn't too bad. And in this contest, you mentioned he had six misses, only one out of five pulls. That's kind of crazy, yeah, especially considering the Ravens ask a lot of their guards in that regard. And it kind of showed how the run game went, that he was underperforming in this one. He was the
player who needed to show the mobility the Ravens didn't have at guard. Remember, their other choices are Ben Cleveland and Alele, and those guys are notoriously immobile. They're more like monolithic right tackle sized players who are in there playing guard, which they could be good at, but they don't have the quickness to do things in the same way. But Voorhees, it's unfortunate to see him go one of five, because that's something they really need. And the Ravens have had some very average athletes in Bozeman, who just got benched, by the way. Bozeman, I did not know this, but Bozeman is a team captain. I think it's for the Chargers now.
I didn't know that.
And he just got benched as their starting center. Might not be the Chargers. I may have the team wrong. It might be the Panthers. Actually. But anyway, wherever he is, he's the team captain. And it's unbelievable. I mean, it's, that would come to pass. But they've James Hurst, another guy that they've gotten some good pulls from, and it's unfortunate it's not working out for Voorhees right now. But hopefully it will. There is still time for him. That NFI year really puts him at a good place on the runway in terms of improving his play. And every game is significant, I'll just say, as we gather additional data points, because we don't have a lot on him now, even through 2 years and five games.
I'm glad you mentioned the box score approach to assessing these offensive linemen, because too often I see a guard or a tackle have a bad game and I just think, okay, well, that's you who you are, a bad player. But it's really not the case. You do have those hot and cold streaks.
You know what? It's worse than that, Sam. We if you go out on Twitter, you're exposed to people just who want to bash the crap out of Daniel Falele in particular, but there's others. They do it to other people. And every individual clip saying he always does this. I've never seen him not do this. You know, they use language that every single one is like, well, if that were true, he'd never step on the field in the first place. Yeah. You know, the guy is, he's simply not as bad as the Twitterverse would have you believe. And the people who are out to get him on Twitter certainly is nowhere near as bad as they would have you believe. He does a lot of things oafishly awful. We'll get to him in a minute, but it does a lot of things that are just oafishly awful on a football field. And he backs that up by having some really slow recognition skills at times that cost him a lot in run blocking situations, but he does a couple things really well. And they're important things. He's a good pass blocker and he doesn't pick up very many penalties. And when you can do those two things, you're generally going to grade pretty positively in my system, because it's much more important than run blocking. It's much more important. All the big exchanges of value are on pass plays. They're not on run plays. So anyway, another, we'll talk about it a little later with Falea, right?
I can't wait because I'm very excited because I do have some comments about him that I think you'll enjoy. But before we move on from Voorhees, yeah, two good games and then this regression. I give him a pass. I know you grade for having the talent on the field, maybe not so much because he's not dealing with the edge rushers, but this Texans defense front seven is just tough. And so hopefully he improves upon his mark. I have high hopes for Voorhees, and hopefully, you know, he continues to improve and they keep him because, you know, there's not a lot of answers on this offensive line outside of Voorhees really on that left guard spot.
You don't have the option to give up on a player after his first bad game. You'd be out of players in about 4 weeks if that were true. So you don't have that option. So Voorhees has earned a little bit of leash from these last two games. This game, he faced a good opponent for a lot of it. And he's a guy who, you know, needs to have more chances to get better, frankly. And hopefully he will, and hopefully he'll get better at some of the things that are not working out right now.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. Any more thoughts on Voorhees?
Sounds good for the game, just in case you're wondering.
Yep, D for the game for Voorhees. Okay, Linderbaum, he is the star of this offensive line, definitely the most well-recognized of the bunch of Ronnie Stanley being out. He's had some tough games, and we talked about it in the first part of the show that I was very high on Linderbaum. You've said he struggled mightily. Mightily might be a strong word, but he struggled this season. What would be your assessment of him in this contest?
So in this game, not a good game, a D+. Now the good news is he didn't have any negative plays other than the penalty. Now he had an IDP foul. It is a serious penalty when it happens. It oftentimes will negate a big positive play, but at the very least it is declinable. In this case, it was declined because the pass went incomplete and the drive was over. But if the pass had been complete for 17 and gotten a first down, that would have been reversed, and they would have almost certainly had the drive stalled because of it on the next play. Those kind of fouls have to be avoided at all costs. They're much, much more serious than false starts, even though both are 5 yards. The IDP fouls and other declinable fouls, much more serious. The scoring system adjusts for that, so he gets a -3 on that play instead of a -2 he would get for a false start specifically. He had six missed blocks. 4 of those were losses at the line of scrimmage, so that wasn't a great day in terms of that. But you would think normally 6 missed blocks and an IDP foul, he'd be okay, and he might get a high C or a B in a game like that. But there was only 40 offensive plays, so that totally changes the thing. He's already lost with 6 missed blocks. He's lost 0.15 of his score deducted from 100 right with that. So then the IDP foul was another. It turns out to be 4 points. It's 3 for the point plus 1 the point he might have had since the play went off. So it's another 4 point loss in there. So tough. Tough for him. He scored 30 out of 40 with adjustment at center. That's still only a D+. Now the centers have a harder grading scale because they call out the assignments and they generally know who they have to block. And if you're a Ravens center and you think you're getting graded not fairly because the curve is too tough, you can I'll give you the number for Matt Burke. You can give him a call because he was the guy who ruined the grading curve for you. He was always fantastic at making block after block. Under those circumstances, I had it actually jacked up to be higher to even get an A during the Burke time because he was just getting A after A week after week. But wow, that's what a 6-time Pro Bowler will do for you when he comes over to play. In Burke's, I think it was his first year with the Ravens, PFF had him as the 22nd most valuable player in all of football.
Wow.
So that tells you a little bit. Now, I don't completely agree with PFF scoring all the time, but he was a tremendous offensive lineman, and the Ravens really had value. He's one of the guys, along with Kelly Gregg, who's on the outside of the Ravens Ring of Honor. But if they had a thin period at some point where they weren't like continually contending and generating stars year after year from the draft, those are the kind of guys who get in, or they might get in under a veteran superstar, a veteran star lounge somewhere within the building where they put up a bunch of other numbers from players like, you know, Kelly Gregg and Matt Burke and others who haven't been with the team as long.
And that's a good segue to this question because, yeah, Matt Burke, you know, his accolades speak for themselves. We thought we were going to see that with Linderbaum, and we haven't really had at least consistently that level of play from him for a first round pick that we got after trading Hollywood Brown. How has he been this season? I haven't had a chance to actually see.
Oh, you want it game by game? You want to hear it?
Let's do game by game. Let's get the grades.
Let me give you that really quick. Take me a second to bring that up. So Linderbaum so far game by game. Okay. In week one against Buffalo, got a C, basically the same, a little bit higher score than he was this time, because 79 plus 0.04. Against Cleveland, D minus, 68 plus 0.05. That's the absolute minimum needed to pass at center. Detroit, he had a B. That was his best game. A C against Kansas City. And then a D plus in this game against Houston. So, you know, in aggregate, he's probably CC minus for the year. And that's just not where the Ravens would hope he is. He's regressed as a pass blocker in particular. And I don't know what they have him pegged for in on PFF in terms of sacks, quarterback hits, and pressures, but he's had a good number of those that he's had partial responsibility for. This was actually his first penalty of the year. That's surprising to me. I thought he had a penalty previously. Had some problems with missed blocks, particularly in the Buffalo game. But other than that, he's been pretty clean on missed blocks.
And he is a guy fighting for a contract. It didn't sound his fifth year option. Ah, man, I don't know. I just don't know with this guy. Again, early in the season, lots of time to turn things around. But I think he needs to step up big time, especially if he wants the contract that he's looking for.
Well, I mean, the Ravens need him to step up. They either need to have him come to agreement on a contract, which is not part of the stepping up. He needs to play well, then get that contract. He needs to earn a contract the Ravens can't afford, and they'll let him walk in free agency if that's the case, and he'll lead the offensive line this year. They'll get real value out of that. Or he needs to step up and play well for 3 weeks right now prior to the trade deadline, and the Ravens then would have a commodity on their hands, which would have real value in terms of offloading. I mean, I think he could be worth, you know, potentially a, I think as much as a second round pick in 2027, and possibly a third round pick in 2026 if they were to trade him before the deadline this year.
Yeah, that will be something to think about. Corey Bullock, I know he just came out of practice squad, but he's a guy that the Ravens may have to push in there if they do make that trade. But, I mean, again, C-minus is great. I mean, yeah. The money that you're looking for, which we expect to be in the $20 million APY range, you're not really earning that money right now, at least in my opinion.
I can't pay him what Creed Humphrey makes. I mean, Creed Humphrey's the best center in the game by a wide margin. He's an order of magnitude better than what Linderbaum has played as so far. I mean, he can't earn that money. He's got to be a little bit less than that, or you have a big competitive disadvantage versus one of your AFC rivals. And you're overpaying for the position. It's just that simple. Yeah.
That's as easy as that. I agree with that completely. Any more thoughts on Linderbaum before we can move on to the head honcho, the guy that everybody loves to talk about, Daniel Falele, right guard for the Baltimore Ravens. He has been, I don't know if there's been an offensive lineman talked more about in any regard. I mean, Marshall Yanda, of course, you know, Jonathan Ogden. I mean, at least in the Twitterverse space, there may not be a player that, you know, Ravens fans talk about more than Daniel Falele. I think he's had a good year considering everything that's gone on. There's been much negatives to the opposite effect of that. But in my opinion, he stepped up in a way in which I didn't really expect after last year. What are your thoughts about him so far this year and in this game in particular?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing nobody likes to hear is that Daniel Falele is playing okay. And that's really the case. I mean, he's played really well at the end of last year. He had one really good game this year, and he had a bad one as well. But this was a C game, and he had another one like it. He gave up half a pressure, which was the only negative play allowed. So he shared a pressure. I think it was with Voorhees. Let me check the actual play that occurred on. No, it was with Noteboom on the 12-yard pass, third play at Q3, if you want to look at the play. That's a half a pressure. So it got 2 points off of what he could have earned on the play by getting a minus one on that. He didn't have a single other negative play. It had 8 missed blocks, but the people who say he always does this, you're never going to run the ball, you're never going to blah, 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 blah without that. Look at the plays. Tell me how many yards you think it cost the Ravens. What Daniel Falele did wrong on those plays, and you're going to come up with a number that's not that extreme, and you realize that, you know, that's just not where the big exchanges of value are. And so run blocking is less important than pass blocking. He missed a bunch of blocks. It's true. He did miss at least one other pass block too, where he got beaten at the line of scrimmage, but 4 were losses at the line of scrimmage. 4 were not losses at the line of scrimmage. So, you know, it's not as bad as everyone would have you believe. He's a pretty much a league average guard at this point. 1 level 2 block, 2 pancakes, 3 out of 5 on poles. Didn't have a highlight in this game. I can take you through his games for the year if you want to hear that. I know people generally don't want to be people listening to the show probably are not the kind of people who are bashing Daniel Falele regularly, because I don't think they could stand listening to the show if they were. I mean, it's so ridiculous. But Daniel Falele got a D against Buffalo, and as the absolute minimum for a D. He had some problems, gave up 2/3 of a sack in that game, quarterback hit, 3/4 of a pressure, but a D in that game. The next game, he got a B+. That game was right in line with his last 5 games of last year. Since then, he's been absolutely the Ravens' most consistent lineman. 3 consecutive Cs. It's a 79 plus a 2 adjustment, a 74 plus a 0.04 adjustment, a 75 plus a 0.03 adjustment. I mean, just he's way more consistent than the box score example I gave earlier would ever allow you to believe could be true for a lineman. But he does, there's nothing you can really point to in his play that's been that bad in terms of his pass blocking. I did have a holding call against Kansas City that was bad. That certainly cost him some points, but generally speaking, he's avoided penalties, and that was his only one of the year. He did have one on 2-point conversion. I should be quiet about that. Also had, really limited number of pass blocking failures on the year. So C grade is what he deserves. Frankly, it's not better or worse than he deserves.
I agree completely. I think that, and my buddy Kevin Ostreicher, who you had on the show earlier, he says it best. I mean, when he loses, he does lose loud, which means when he loses, you notice it on the film at times. But for the most part, he's an average guard. I mean, the beginning of last year, I believe he was awful, but his strides are noticeable. He's cheap. Ravens fans are going to be upset when the Ravens re-sign him and bring him back, but I would not be surprised if the Ravens go that route, unless the Ravens would take that approach of, let's make this offensive line as great as possible in terms of run blocking, pass blocking, everything. Let's make a push for that. But it's not a premium position. There's other positions of need. No one's going to have the perfect Pro Bowl roster in the National Football League. I'm impressed. I'm very happy and excited with his growth. I mean, his ceiling is as high as it can be. So there is room for improvement. Obviously, we know he's not the most athletic guy in the offensive line room, but I mean, he's played good football for me, at least so far.
You make a good point in terms of the possibility for improvement. The reason there's a possibility for improvement on a player like Falele is very segmented within his failures. So he's got a bunch of failures in mobility. He's probably never going to get a lot better in terms of that. But he's got a bunch of other, in terms of processing, that he absolutely can get better at. And that's something that they should look to try and fix and improve. They've already fixed other things about his game. He does seem to really work hard at that, but they fixed the penalties, which were a huge issue at the beginning of last year. They fixed some of the pass blocking problems, and he's had many fewer pass blocking events. It's just, people don't want to give him any benefit of the doubt. So you'll literally be able to find just about every clunky, terrible block that he fails to make in any given week will show up on Twitter. You don't get that for other players. You certainly don't get that for Tyler Linderbaum. Nobody's putting together the...
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, get up to 80% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, seasonal decor, and way more. All at Wayfair. These are Wayfair's best deals of the year. From seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, enjoy fast and free shipping with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 80% off during Wayfair's Black Friday sale. Now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
A clip of here's every crappy Tyler Linderbaum block that happened during a week. And it just Falele tends to be a little underrated because of it.
Yeah, I wish he got some respect because he, and again, the processing thing that you mentioned, that was my number one issue with Falele. Defensive front, stunts, those are things of that nature, acquiring your target, knowing where he is. Those are the things that he needs to improve upon. But the other things have been exponentially better this year. And as you mentioned, he's the most consistent offensive lineman on your team currently. There's a lot of ebbs and flows with the offensive line play. This guy's been steady for the most part. So I'm impressed with Falele. Sorry to say it, guys. I know there's some people out there in the Twitterverse who are upset with it, but man, he's played some pretty good football. All right, let's get into Rosengarten because he's the guy that, again, has that potential to move to the left tackle spot. When they drafted him, we thought that if Ronnie Stanley didn't return, then maybe he's the guy that can move. What is your assessment of Rosengarten so far this year and then this game in particular?
Okay, well, I'll give you the grades for the year since I just happen to move over in the spreadsheet right now. But he got an F in game one against Buffalo, looked really bad in that game. And it wasn't really close to passing, about 13 points short of a passing grade. Against Cleveland, he got an A, then a C minus, then an A minus, and then a B. So he's played really well since that first game at Buffalo in aggregate. This game, he was pretty much right in the middle of that last four-game stretch. He did have seven missed blocks. He had one-third of a sack, not one-third of a quarterback hit. He had one-third of a sack that he shared with Noteboom on the play we talked about earlier, where number 97 ended up getting the sack, but the two edge rushers both chased Rush out of the pocket. He had seven missed blocks in this game, which is not a small number, but he also had five losses at the line of scrimmage, which is the more troubling number. The other side of that coin is that he's facing really tough edge rushers every single play, between it being either Anderson or Hunter on that side. A few snaps for other players, but mostly Anderson or Hunter. He was 2-on-2 on pulls, didn't have a level 2 block, didn't have a highlight in this game, and didn't have a pancake. But he's made some good blocks for the Ravens this year, certainly, and he's been a better pass blocker, I think, than we could reasonably have hoped, given the less help that he's got. So I think he's basically been the player that the Ravens could reasonably hope he would be under less favorable circumstances than he had last year.
Yeah, I know you were definitely critical of him last year because he needed help. Let's be honest. Lots of chip blocks, lots of sets in his direction to help him out. This year, he hasn't had that help because of injuries, and it seems like he's played pretty well. So very good to see in regards to Rosengarten, correct?
Yeah. I'm happy with it, but let's move on. Let's talk some skill position players. You're the guest, and I've been bringing up offensive linemen here. Tell us who you'd like to talk about in terms of the skill players.
We got to talk about Derrick Henry. We got to mention Derrick Henry here. I'm concerned with his play. Now, again, the run blocking hasn't been superb for Henry, and the lack of Lamar Jackson in this contest didn't help things as well, because the team was keying in on stopping Derrick Henry, because they knew if they stopped Derrick Henry, the ball's in Cooper Rush's hand, and you got a good chance to win the football game in that regard. But still, even with that, he's regressed. And as we mentioned earlier, so has Saquon Barkley. So I'm going to be very interested to see how he plays up this year. He just got signed a new contract. Big-time decision coming up for Derrick Henry. He needs to get things going. The fumbles haven't helped, but really, I just haven't seen, besides that Buffalo Bills game and maybe a little bit in that Chiefs game last week, not much in the way of huge production from him, in my opinion.
It's been a bad yards after contact for Derek, which is a year, but it's also based on the yards before contact. And so this last game, he was average being hit at the line of scrimmage. If you look at the PFF totals, you'll see that Derek Henry had 2.2 yards after contact per attempt and 2.2 yards per attempt, which means his average point of contact is at the line of scrimmage. So, that is not his normal level. And he's had 3.19 yards after contact per attempt, which was basically all during the Buffalo game, where he had 6 yards after contact per attempt. Since then, hasn't had a single game higher than 2.45. Everything's between 1.5 and 2.45. And that's really bad territory. He's a 363 career yards after contact guy, and 360 last year in the DVOA charted out as the best running back year of the 21st century. We did expect some regression. I mean, if you didn't, you're foolish. I'll put it this way. If you really thought he'd go for 2,000 yards instead of 1,900 because everything was going to be better, well, a whole bunch of things aren't better, starting with Lamar Jackson's not there.
I'm very concerned with it. But again, Lamar Jackson comes back, I think his production will increase, especially if they change some things around and some guys get healthy. I expect him to return. But something to look out for this season is, I'm sure the numbers would not equate nowhere near what he did in 2024.
All right, I'll go next. I'll DeAndre Hopkins. Let's talk about him, because we want to talk about a bright spot. We have a lot of negatives we're talking about in terms of a game like this. But DeAndre Hopkins manages to find an opportunity to catch the football. I was going to say get open, but that's not really always the case. He caught another contested ball in this game. He also caught another ball that was not contested. And he is, I believe, leading the entire NFL, at least in terms of wide receivers, because that's what I checked. All wide receivers had 5 or more targets. He leads in yards per target at 17.4, which is an outrageous number, particularly for a guy who has a lot of trouble getting open.
Yeah, and Lamar Jackson trusts him completely, as does Cooper Rush, it appears. I mean, if he has one-on-one coverage, and I've said this on my show a lot of times, one-on-one coverage on the outside, Lamar Jackson has time. He's going to throw it to him because he trusts that he's going to make the grab. And more often than not, he has been able to make those grabs. So he has been a bright spot. If for some reason this Ravens team turns it around and they get into the postseason, they'll have something that they haven't had in quite a while, since the days of a guy by the name of Anquan Boldin. So I will be very happy to see him perform. But yeah, so far so good. He's been a bright spot in a ways that I wasn't 100% sure he'd be able to contribute, especially early on this season.
He's only played 11 snaps in this game and had two catches. So maybe it's another guy that everybody knows is getting the football when he comes in the game. You can see I'm a little bit bitter about that particular comment. But Hopkins has had a very low total snap count for the year. It's remarkable what he's been able to accomplish. It's only 9 targets, but you know, we're getting to be like what the full season looked like for Wallace last year, where he had, I think it was 12 for 192. You know, he's 3/4 of the way towards that, and with a higher yards per target so far. Probably won't hold up even for 3 more targets, but you know, he's close, and he's just been remarkably good. We haven't really seen him on a lot of rundowns. One of the things I thought he needed to do for the Ravens was be a big run blocker, or more than that, be a guy who would get under people's skin in the wide receiver room when they're watching film or when they're on the field about making your run blocks. He was a great run blocker in early in his career. He was a big body, really knew how to get in the way, keep his feet. He's not that anymore. And he's been a guy who's probably had a little lower effort in run situations in recent years. You know, certainly really even since he left Houston a number of years ago to go to the Cardinals, that really started the degradation process. It would have been really nice if he took the mantle for that. If he'd have done that, I mean, I think he'd have been, you know, certainly the positional captain, maybe even is, you know, he'll never be the guy who gets the most snaps anymore, but he could be the guy who's the number one in the film room and says, hey, look, that ain't going to cut it. The guy who pulls the rookie aside and says, you got to keep your feet on that play kind of thing.
He might need to be that guy to step up and do that, because they could certainly use the juice upon that offensive line Bateman. Don't give me. In fact, let's talk about Bateman. Great segue. Let's talk about Bateman, who finds his way again in the ire of Ravens fans, because he just, I mean, that interception by Cooper Rush, that's a ball that you have to fight for. And that just seems to be the mantra of Bateman at times. Now, again, I think he's one of the best route runners in the league when given the opportunity. Certainly, I think he would have a better output if he was on an offense that had that type of timing acumen, kind of like with the Cincinnati Bengals, what they had, or the early days of Aaron Rodgers with the Green Bay Packers. But regardless, he has just found ways to not fight at all and given outputs. And the frustration, I guess, is there with the way the offense is playing. But, man, I'm very disappointed with his production so far this year as well. I mean, Flowers has taken it upon himself to be that guy. Hopkins, not so much a Bateman.
You know, if I'm looking around at players who, and a lot of people just want to generally hyperbolize and generally say nobody is trying, there's a whole bunch of players out there for the Ravens who are trying. And there's a few who are more concerned about either getting hurt or they're just not into it in the way they were. Bateman, unfortunately, that play, you know, makes him a poster child for not giving maximum effort. There might be all kinds of things. He might have lost to the sun. He might have, remember last year when it wasn't an interception. I think it was an incomplete pass.
It was incomplete. Yeah.
And he pointed up the sky immediately, and that, you know, the sun was in his eyes. I mean, give me a break. Give me a freaking break. You want to tell that to Lamar when you get back to the huddle? He won't care either, but at least you won't embarrass yourself to 70,000 other people who are in the immediate vicinity, kind of watching you make that signal. Another, you know, few million on TV. It was one of those places not good. And they've signed Bateman for a long time. So they really need to cultivate him in every way they need him. He's not a bad run blocker. He's a guy who can help the team in that regard. He just has to want to. He's a great route runner. He could be a very high value, high yards per target receiver with the right quarterback. That was with Lamar. But he's got to want to. And if he did that to Lamar one time, I mean, Lamar would lose a lot of trust they built over the last year and a half or so. You know, would all of a sudden be gone in one play.
Got to have that effort. Got to have that 1-2. Didn't see it there. Again, losing effort. You're down by a lot, but you're a professional. You got to be out there and you got to fight. So it was definitely hard to watch, honestly. Hopefully he rebounds in this upcoming game, but definitely somebody to keep an eye on. throughout the remainder of the season.
I got one more guy to bring up here, and then if you have anybody else, that's great too. But Zay Flowers, I really expected this to be a game where his role was kind of diminished, and the reason being that they needed to get the ball out of Cooper Rush's hands quickly. A lot of the deep crosses that Zay really lives on are things that require more time and space. Now, I was fortunate Cooper Rush did have a couple times, nine times, in fact, in this game where he had ample time space. And one of those, he managed to get off a nice deep ball to Flowers that Flowers ended up running down, having time to get up off the turf. And I still think he should have outmaneuvered the guy for a score right there, but it didn't happen. But anyway, you know, the play that reminded me of is Jacoby Jones in the Super Bowl.
Yes.
Making a catch way down the field. You know, he basically reverses the field completely, runs out to the other side of the field. There's people chasing him, but you know, he knows he can outrun them horizontally. He just needs to keep that horizontal path for longer. And Flowers seemed to cut it upfield too early, which is really weird. I mean, I didn't completely figure out, you know, what he was trying to do there, but he cut it up the field too early and allowed himself to be tackled. Unfortunately, they did score anyway, but that would have been ugly if they'd had to settle for three or turn it over or something in that inside of the 4-yard line.
Yeah, fans always get on Flowers about the way he runs after the catch and, you know, maneuver away from the tackler. But yeah, if he had just gone horizontal, you would have scored, buddy. I mean, it is what it is. But I will say, Flowers is, again, showing that he is the top tier wide receiver one for this team. Again, as you mentioned, I did not expect a big game out of Flowers in this game. One, because I thought the running game would be more prominent. And two, because as you mentioned, they're going to get the ball out quicker with those slants and whatnot and screens and what have you. And that wouldn't really tailor to Zay Flowers' game plan. But not to be the case, but I'm still very impressed with Flowers so far in this game and throughout the season.
All right. Do you have any other players you want to talk about? We do have a couple questions in the mailbag we should get to if we can.
Nobody else. But I will say Mitchell. I need more Keaton Mitchell. Get me Keaton Mitchell on the field, John Harbaugh. Don't keep him out because of whatever you may think would be the case as far as game planning. He deserves to be on the field.
Yeah, I mean, it was nice at least to see him. Okay, so they got Mitchell on the field for 4 plays in this game. They got Ali on the field for 0 plays, and they've only gotten Ali on the field, I think, for less than 4 plays the entire season before this when he's been active and Mitchell hasn't. That at least speaks to the notion that the balance, the tipping point, was due to special teams. So I don't think Harbaugh is lying to us in that case. He might be misvaluing it, he's not lying to us in terms of why he activated Ali over Mitchell. And it is nice that given the option of both, he picks Mitchell over Ali because it's the obvious choice in terms of offensive value. Ali's had some problems on special teams recently in terms of holding onto the football initially on some of the kick returns. That won't sit well. And it could well be that Ali, when there's any pressure again on the active list, and there's no pressure this week because every healthy body dressed and they elevated 2 and they still had the 6 highest played players on the team, not available, you know, kind of thing. But right now, so there's no reason why Mitchell would not be active right now. But when the time comes again, I think it might be Mitchell over Ali.
Better be.
Yeah, make a lot of sense. All right, let's go to a couple of mailbag questions here. I'll read them, and you kind of give us a first response, and then I'll if I need to add anything to what you say, that'd be great. We got this from John Prestiani. He says, Ken, before this horrible start, I was worried why Lamar had not signed an extension. I wondered if he wanted out of Baltimore due to coaching. John Harbaugh is a good coach, but not elite. Consistently, we don't have to agree with any of this, by the way, consistently outcoached by Casey and other top tier coaches. Thoughts?
My thought is, I don't think Lamar Jackson didn't sign the extension because of anything to do with John Harbaugh. I think it's just that either he didn't get the numbers he wanted and he has the cards. He doesn't have to sign an extension, especially this season. Upcoming season with the $70+ million cap hit, that's a different story, but he's in a no rush to get a job done. It's on the onus of the front office, in my opinion, to get him that contract. But I don't think the contract talks are related to anything going on with the front office roster or head coach.
I would agree. And I think that one of the things about it is he may realize he's got, you know, all the leverage in the world kind of thing, but he's still under contract for 2 years. And that's a lot of risk to take personally if anything were to happen. If you want to talk to somebody about risk, talk to Namdi Madubuike. You know, talk to Ardarius Washington, you know, who lost a big payday with his injury. There are plenty of instances where you can point to a player basically losing out. Namdi Madubuike, I mean, he's fortunate. He was signed before he had, you know, what could be a very serious injury. I don't want to say career ending when I don't know career ending, but it's possible. And, you know, you certainly, he's very fortunate for him that he signed it. Actually, very unfortunate for the Ravens that he signed it when he did. Ronnie Stanley has done a great job timing up the signing of his contracts with getting hurt afterwards and not beforehand, in terms of being ready to go. So I think Lamar has lots of people on the team he could talk to about this directly, but I think it does make sense for both sides to get a contract done before this next season begins. And there's additional injury risk for Lamar. And it certainly makes sense for a cap perspective for the Ravens to get it done. And I don't share a lot of John's opinions on where Harbaugh fits in terms of elite coaching. If you ever looked at just what percentage of coaches that have ever coached in National Football League history do you think have a winning record? I used to know this percentage exactly. I can only approximate it now.
Oh, man, I don't know. Winning record? I'd say probably 30, 40% maybe.
Why would it be that low? I mean, you win half the games.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's tough to win in this league. And if you lose, you get fired pretty quickly. So I think that the percentage would be pretty low.
Okay, so you're right. It's something like a third or 30%.
Yes.
And yeah, so congratulations, Sam. I can say you're happy with the result of that. But if lots of coaches go 0-5, 1-5, 1-4, 1-6, and they're done. But there are very few coaches who can win consistently for a long period of time. Harbaugh has been one of them. He has a host of big advantages in terms of getting teams ready to play big games. If you want to start talking about coaches that have a lot going wrong for them and yet have stood around the league for, I mean, the loyalty the Steelers have had to Mike Tomlin is amazing. He's had, lost all these consecutive postseason games, hasn't won one in 10 years. The guy leads the league in cowardly punts every year in terms of not going for it on fourth down. There's no more backwards game management coach than Tomlin. And yet, you have these two in the same division, and somehow it's the Ravens fans who don't realize what they have. There are, by the way, there's a ton of people in Pittsburgh who are in the Fire Tomlin crowd every year. But it seems like the Fire Harbaugh crowd, it's loud even during the off season. And obviously it's cacophonous now in terms of what's going on with the team struggling a little bit. So you can't get away from it on Twitter. I do think that said that there is a risk for Harbaugh, probably a small one here at the bye, and then a big one at the end of the season. I think that'd be the time. They don't have access to good coaches right now, which should be the reason why they just wait it out, see if they can right the ship. If it doesn't work out, they can figure out what they need to do during this offseason. I'll say this, it's Bisciotti's job to make this decision. It's not anybody else's. Mm-hmm. And it's not DaCosta's job, although Bisciotti might consult with him. That silo, the entire silo of coaching from the top down, reports directly to Bisciotti. So there's no one else who, Sashi Brown, no one else like that who has a say in this thing, unless, it's something that Bisciotti actively seeks out. And I say he is an expert at hiring, and particularly in this kind of tiered organization or hiring, which is very naturally what football falls into. He's had a great record of doing it in his other businesses, and I think he'll make the right choice with Harbaugh.
Yeah, I will say I was at the facility the day that they hired John Harbaugh, and the name of the game was continuity. They wanted to make sure they had a guy that was going to be there for the long haul. So I will say that, again, there's a chance that John Harbaugh gets fired in the middle of the season. There's a chance he gets fired at the end of the season, depending on the outcome of this game. Do not be surprised if John Harbaugh stays because, again, that relationship is tight. And as you mentioned, again, John Harbaugh does not report to Eric DaCosta. Eric DaCosta reports to Steve Bisciotti. Harbaugh reports to Steve Bisciotti. Sashi Brown, Steve Bisciotti. Everything is solid towards the owner. And that's a pretty good way of doing it, especially considering that a lot of these guys have gotten very close over the years. Don't be surprised if Harbaugh's back. And it's because, as you mentioned, he wins games when it's all said and done. And if you think that the Ravens aren't going to come out of here with a winning record, think again. Harbaugh has that potential to get things under control, and that could possibly save his job.
It could, and it's just at the radio station today. And Rob Long says, look, if the Ravens come back and finish with a winning record this year, even make the playoffs, it's going to be 100% number 8. And I'm like, that can't possibly be. That cannot possibly be. If you're if they come back and have a great second half, you can't possibly give 100% of the credit to Lamar Jackson. Even if he comes back and wins the MVP, which is not out of the question, I suppose, given you know, he started off statistically very good, and if the Ravens return, there's going to be real reasons to believe it's true. I mean, Harbaugh will have a hand in it, yeah. and there will be reasons to do it. Harbaugh's also signed for 3 years. I believe he signed through 2028.
Yeah.
So if the natural time to let him go would be when he's got 1 year left on his deal, because the coach and the owner typically don't want a coach on a 1 year deal. But with 3 years left, I mean, that's might be as much as about $60 million that Bisciotti would owe him for nothing if he decided he wanted to cut him loose now. And they could make an arrangement and mutually agree to walk and not be paid for it. But I don't think Harbaugh would be of a mind to do that at this point in his career.
To play devil advocate, they did do something similar with Brian Billick. I mean, Brian Billick had a lot of years left on his contract, and they still let him go. Again, as you mentioned, I'm telling you, again, I'm as frustrated as everybody with the way this is performed has gone out. But if there's a coach in the league that can turn things around from a systemic aspect, a guy, a CEO of the football field from top to bottom, it's John Harbaugh. And don't be surprised if you see changes upcoming with this roster, with the way they play. And if the Ravens do make a turnaround, Lamar Jackson, yes, has a hand in it for sure, but from top to bottom, it's all on John Harbaugh. John Harbaugh will be the guy that gets that credit for sure. And you know, he deserves it. He'll have that opportunity.
It's not outrageous that Zach Orr might have a hand in it. It's probably less likely because he might be gone, but it's not outrageous that Zach Orr would do it. And let's say Pagano takes over as interim defensive coordinator and rights the ship on defense all of a sudden. Well, who hired him? who gets a little bit of the credit if that happens? Exactly. To go right, you know, kind of thing. So anyway. All right, so I think that's it for the mailbag tonight. We had maybe one other question here. Let me see. Now, this is something I didn't actually see whether this happened or not, but a good question from Minion Hunter, who's a regular contributor to Film Study Mailbag. So, Minion Hunter, we appreciate you, by the way. But he says, were you able to observe the energy level of the coaches on Sunday, Harbin, Monken, or Orr? And he specifically asked, how did they respond to Rashad Bateman not going after the football? And I did not see it at the stadium. In fact, we walked out after the last time the ball had been given up. Rarely ever do that, but obviously they were getting their asses kicked. And I actually want to get home, beat the traffic, and start analysis. And it's a small thing, but one of the things I have to budget during a year is my total recording space on my DVR.
Yes.
And I have to be careful about not having an extra hour record if I don't have to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I didn't see the reaction on the field, but I did see his reaction when the question was asked during this press conference on Monday, John Harbaugh. He was definitely a little, you could tell he was miffed by, he understood that Bateman probably gave up on the play, and it's something that he would talk to him about. I wouldn't make too big a deal of it outside of that. It's something that the Ravens would talk to him about, but I don't think that's anything indicative of Rashad Bateman moving forward one way or another as far as playing time or the coaching staff as a whole. But I do know that it's something that the coach would probably talk to him about, but it's something that happens time and time
again. I asking something like that is asking the coach to nail a player for something he did. And Harbaugh doesn't want to do that for starters.
Yeah.
So when you ask him a question like that, it's not his first choice. Now, he's been backed into some corners talking about play calling recently where he's already said some things that immediately strike people as being un-Harbaugh, like about talking to Monken about certain play calls and that he didn't, you know. I mean, I think it's that much better when you're talking about it, but you still – If you've ever seen Saving Private Ryan, there's a scene where he talks about you complain up, you don't complain down. I can't complain to you about what's going wrong with this. I have to complain to whoever the next guy up is. You don't complain down. You don't complain to the media about what's going on with your defensive coordinator. You don't complain to the media about your players either. You try and keep these things in-house.
Yeah, again, you mentioned he was put into a corner. And the funny, interesting thing, Jeff Zebrek of The Athletic talked about how John Harbaugh doesn't say anything for no reason. He's not the type of guy that goes on the media and just talks off the cuff. There's a reason why he says something. Could have been something that he had a conversation with Monken before the press conference. And, hey, I'm going to say this to kind of see where your players, how they respond to, to my criticism of you, but something to think about again as well. But yeah, I think that to your point, if that's not the case, you definitely don't want to complain to the media. As much as the fans, when they hear you, you know, choose a side or say something to lift their spirits about the loss and outcome, as a head coach, you just can't do it.
Yeah. All right. Sam, always great talking football. We really appreciate you making time for this. We're done a little bit sooner than we are typically on a week, but not sure that everybody has really the stomach for discussing a 44-10 loss in the same way that they would with a win. Tell folks where they can find you, because you're all over the place now in terms of podcasts and your Twitter handle.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Ravens Talk Podcast. Always there, available, talking football. I have some clips from our show that you can find on YouTube and wherever you get your podcast. You can find Ravens Talk Podcast as well. I do a podcast with Kevin Ostreicher and Kadri Ismail twice a week called the Locked On Ravens Squad Show. We talk all things Ravens, and one of the post game shows will be on as well. So we have a post game show and then a regular show on Wednesdays, and then we have the AFC North Roundtable, where each representative from the various teams in the division discuss the games and predict the outcome of the next week's game.
All right, very good. Other folks out there, thanks for listening. As always, we appreciate the loyalty of the fans of the show to a tremendous degree, and appreciate the number of listens, which I'm sure there are some pods which are really suffering in terms of listens right now. Not the case here. Really appreciate that. You guys have been great. As always, promote the show, please, by word of mouth when possible. Tell that one extra person that you know doesn't do it. I'm not algorithm-driven the way a lot of the other shows are. I'm not trying to feed a big YouTube subscription group or anything like that. You guys are a select group. And I don't mean that in a negative way. That would be if you were Spinal Tap fans. I mean it more in the way that you guys are a lot of STEM professionals and other clearly very nerdy, very brainy, I meant to say, and sometimes nerdy people as well, who really appreciate this show. And I appreciate you too very much. Love to have more of you on. If you want to do a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. And I'd love to hear from you. Sam, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for having me on, buddy.
And we'll talk to you.